Hello, welcome to the final episode in what has been our very first four-episode series, and it has been on Russia, the recent history of Russia, end of the Soviet Union, rise of Putin, obviously very, very immediate, important subject at the moment. And we have reached the stage where Putin has become president of Russia. So Dominic, the election of 2000, is Putin, I mean, is he a popular figure at this point? Is he well known or is he a kind of new broom?
It's the funny thing. He's unknown. A year earlier, he was unknown. He's a new broom. A year earlier, he was completely unknown. But by, April 2000, I think it is, he is identified with the Second Chechen War, which has been a great success from the Russian perspective, because they've basically wiped the floor with the, as Putin, I think his expression is, he says, we've greased the terrorists, I think is his expression. He sort of has this populist way of talking about the war that pleases a lot of ordinary Russians. So just on the Chechen War, there is a guerrilla war that goes on for years. There's the Beslan siege. Remember that, Tom? In the school 2004, where Chechen militants took hundreds of people hostage in the theater. And both occasions, the Russian armed forces storm the place where the people are being held hostage, and lots of people are killed in the crossfire. Horrific. But Putin ends up winning in Chechnya. So the Chechen guy who they install in the long run is a guy called Ramzan Kadyrov. Are you familiar with him, Tom?
No.
He is an absolutely terrible man.
Is he the one who's still on the scene now?
Yeah.
He's the guy who wants to go in and murder everyone in Ukraine.
He is.
Yes, I am familiar with him.
So he's an Instagram addict. He's had a tiff with John Oliver, the American comedy presenter on Instagram. He does have a comedy beard. His birthday party in 2011 was attended by Jean-Claude Van Damme, Hilary Swank, Seal, and Vanessa May, the violinist.
What a party that must have been.
Well, our producer was telling us that John Oliver is English, but I think of him as American.
Yeah, he is English. He was a comedy partner of Andy Zeltzman.
I know, but he's famous in America.
The TMS, the Test Match Special scorer.
He's not famous in England, is he?
That's 2 degrees of separation from Test Match Special to the Chechen warlord.
Wow. Well, okay.
That's brilliant.
So anyway, you actually, the question was actually, I was just determined to read my notes about Ramzan Kadyrov.
fair enough. That was worth it.
The question was actually, how did Putin win? Well, he won on the back of...
Because he's fighting a communist, isn't he? Gennady Zyuganov.
Well, yes, right. He's fighting... Zyuganov was the guy who Yeltsin beat in 96, and he's also going to run again in 2000, the communist. Putin is younger. He's the new broom. He's hard. He's won the war. So, of course, people vote for him. He's very, very good at... The weird thing is, actually, in 2000, if you look at some of the sort of press commentary in the West, people said, well, maybe he'd be more liberal. You know, obviously, we started the previous podcast with George W. Bush's now, frankly, blackly ironic, you know, stuff about looking into his soul and inviting him to his ranch because he thought he could trust him. Putin, nobody actually knows what Putin is. Putin is a blank slate in 2000. But he is lucky. His reign coincides with a sort of uptick in oil prices, and Russia's going to start to make a lot of money from oil and gas. They've finally reached some degree of economic stability after the chaos of the 90s. Also, a thing that Putin does that isn't appreciated, I think, popularly in the West as much as it is, he cracks down on the oligarchs.
He does, doesn't
very
he?
Very popular.
Yes, he does.
Boris
Berezovsky, the notorious one, isn't it?
Well, it's notorious because he, was found hanged in, I think, 2011. And there's always
outside Ascot.
Yeah, there was this suspicion about what happened to him.
And Khodorkovsky also, who you mentioned earlier.
Yes, exactly.
The richest man in Russia.
He was the richest man in Russia. And had been very close to Yeltsin, had known Putin, there are lots of photos of them together, but had dared to criticize Putin and had to argue with him. And basically Putin has him, you know, all of these oligarchs.
Sent to a labor camp.
Yeah, he's sent to prison for 10 years in Siberia.
Yeah, very Dostoevsky. I mean,
just absolutely.
And then he serves his term and he gets another 6 years.
Yeah, Putin pardoned him, I think, in 2014 and basically.
Well, he's in London as well.
Yeah. I mean,
so all these oligarchs flee to London.
One of the things that people say about Abramovich is that, why did Abramovich buy Chelsea? Buying Chelsea was actually a brilliant way of protecting himself. It made him very famous, gave him a bolt hole in London, gave him a place in the kind of British and Western imagination.
Oligarch
as something other as some yeah as something other than just a kind of the guy who ran Sibneft, and it made him harder to touch. You know,
well,
it would
because
be
Berezovsky takes him to court, doesn't he? In London,
Berezovsky did take him. They had a massive
scrapping over the corpse of it.
They were absolutely. So, what actually Putin's reign, in some ways, has represented is the kind of securocrats, the Siloviks, the Siloviki, as they're called, taking power back. So, people who are involved with the army, particularly with the intelligence services, they are the people who surround Putin now more than ever. Not so much the people with the sort of the glitzy yachts who made all their money in the 90s, because there's been a bit of a backlash against them. It's the securocrats who really have run the show in the last 20 years.
So Dominic, I haven't read hugely about this period, but one book that really, really sticks in my mind was by Peter Pomerantsev, who was actually born in Kiev, I think. His parents were exiled to Britain, and so he grew up British. And then he went to Moscow to work in TV in the early years of Putin's presidency. And he wrote a brilliant book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. And his theme essentially is that Putin's power rests on his ability to manipulate reality, and that he is bringing the expertise that he has garnered as a KGB officer. And he is recruiting all the people, all this kind of the security services who've done this, quite a lot of the ideologues as well in the Soviet period. And they, essentially he's weaponizing them. And Pomerantsev points out that when Putin becomes president, the first things that he essentially gets his claws on, it's not the utilities, it's not the oil, it's not even the security services, it's TV. And that he uses TV to create a kind of hall of mirrors. And I don't know whether you think that that's a theory that you would go along with.
Well, you definitely see the hall of mirrors now, don't you? I mean, there are accounts, social media accounts online that are, I can't remember the name of the guy who's doing it. There's a particular guy who's Francis something, who's got this incredible account where he tells you what's on Russian TV every night during the Ukraine war. And the parallel world, the parallel reality, the fact that basically they're showing pictures of Kyiv that look like nothing that's happening now. They're fake, basically, or all these sort of things. I mean, you're right, there is a hall of mirrors, and to some extent there always has been. But I don't think it's purely that. I think for a lot of Russians, Putin does represent stability and strength, because if you think about the story that we've told, the 80s and 90s, of course he represents stability after that. Utter chaos.
And so that's the importance of his masculinity, the bare chest and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's all laughable to us, but to them, better that than Boris not getting off the plane, or Gorbachev, just sort of lost in his own committees and reading Lenin and everything kind of falling to pieces around him. They see Putin projecting kind of old-fashioned masculine strength, don't they? And I think that obviously has a tremendous appeal. Plus, there is this thing, the Weimar parallel that you mentioned right at the beginning, the Robert Harris thing. I mean, one of the things that animated Germany in the 1920s and then the 30s was this sense of amputation. There are all these Germans cut off. And Putin and his sort of ideologues, the people who are in this sort of TV hall of mirrors, they can say, 30% of the population of Estonia when the Soviet Union broke up was Russian speaking. All these people in Eastern Ukraine speak Russian. People in Transnistria and Moldova. I mean, that's what they've weaponized, a genuine sort of sense of grievance about the what people see as the mutilation of kind of Russianness and the Russian nation.
But also a sense that a war can be a kind of source of empowerment, that it will make Russians feel good while also, I guess, intimidating them, because, you're getting this news footage from Grozny or whatever, and you're thinking, well, if he can do that there, what could he do to us? I mean, that's also, so there's a kind of, you're simultaneously being empowered and intimidated by this. Would that be true?
I suppose that is true. People are frightened of Putin. They'd be frightened of him even without a war. I mean, the war in Crimea, for the annexation of Crimea, I mean, there wasn't really a war in Crimea. It was just a sort of a silent coup, the little green men, and then the annexation. I mean, that was tremendously popular in Russia. Opinion polls showed it was very popular. The war in the Donbass, that's your Hall of Mirrors, because Russians believe that they haven't been fighting in the Donbass. They think that it's purely separatists fighting Ukrainian Nazis. I mean, that stuff is crazy.
Okay, let's take a quick break, make a cup of tea, maybe have a slug of vodka, and we'll see you after the ads. Hello, welcome back to The Rest is History. So, Peter Pomerantsev argues that in the noughties, Russian democracy, you know, it becomes show business. It becomes a kind of source of entertainment that you allow people on political shows. So you have communists, you know, to appeal to the old people, and you have, you know, liberals to appeal to the nerds, and you have nationalists, you know, who are kind of mad but quite entertaining. But it's like watching the Big Brother house. And if you go too far, you know, if you start misbehaving, if you start directly threatening Putin, then you'll be voted off the Big Brother house. You know, you will just vanish. And so democracy is degraded into becoming a form of entertainment, and then it just kind of fades away completely. Now, I thought that was, you know, really, really kind of fascinating take. But the other, I listened to a podcast.
Tom.
I actually listened to a podcast, and it was Jordan Peterson's podcast.
Well, oh my God, people are either whooping for joy, Tom, or they're turning off right now.
And he had on a guy called Frederick Kagan, who's a military historian, specialist in Russia, son of a famous classicist. And he, I would guess, is pretty much the opposite of Pomerantsev. So Peter Pomerantsev writes for the LRB. You know, he's very much that kind of world. Frederick Kagan, I would get, well, I mean, definitely, because he's on a Jordan Peterson podcast, is not the kind of guy who would give his pronouns.
Right. But he definitely wouldn't give them to Jordan Peterson.
But he's basically saying the same thing. He's talking about Putin's policy in Crimea, and he's talking about hybrid warfare, this idea that you, essentially what you're doing is you're creating, again, this idea of a hall of mirrors where nothing is real. You can't be certain what anything is. And his aim is to get people, particularly in the West, but also in Ukraine and Russia, to look at the war and to say, well, you know, we don't really know what the truth is. There's probably a bit of this, there's a bit of that, when basically it's just an invasion. And he produced this astonishing fact that I hadn't realized, that the negotiations at Minsk in 2014 to try and kind of arrive at a settlement between Russia and Ukraine, Russia isn't a kind of participant in the peace talks. It's an arbiter. It's there with France and Germany as an arbiter.
Yeah, they're pretending that they're not. You see, they're
completely
that's the point. They're pretending they're not really involved.
Yeah. Whereas what's changed this time round is that now Putin is doing it absolutely nakedly. I mean, there's no attempt to create this kind of hall of, I guess, because it's been blown out of the water by the CIA. But
there is a hall of mirrors in Russia. I mean, there is a colossal chasm between what ordinary Russians think about the war and what we think about it that did not exist with, for example, when they went into Georgia in 2008. So that was probably the moment when, that was the trial run, if you like, the war against Georgia. So George W. Bush, who appeared in the previous podcast, George W. Bush had said, we're thinking about NATO membership for Ukraine and Georgia. You know, they can aspire to it. And at that point, obviously, alarm bells went off in the Kremlin. And the first thing Putin did was go into Georgia just months later. So what happened then? You know, brutal war, all the rest of it. But I don't think there was a sense then of an iron curtain, as it were.
No, but even in 2014, there wasn't, because there were lots of people in the West who said, oh, well, you know, the Ukrainians are all fascists. That argument that the Ukrainians are fascists, which was absolutely kind of generated by Putin's genius for malevolent propaganda. I mean, not entirely, but definitely you know, quite significantly. And that played a crucial role in persuading the West not to get too het up about, you know.
Yes, I suppose so. I mean, I think that, but also it's the fact that the Russians now are so sealed off. So, you know, it's virtually impossible now, I think, for ordinary Russians to get hold of a lot of the sort of, you know, can they listen to this podcast? I don't know. You know, they are sealed off in a way they weren't in in 2014, I suppose. But my question to you, Tom, which I wanted to ask was, how is that different, that kind of Hall of Mirrors telling a story about what you're doing? How is that different from what people would have done in history? I mean,
it's funny you ask that, because when I read Pomerantz's book, what it reminded me of was Augustan Rome.
Yeah.
The creation of fantastical stories that kind of almost anesthetized people who'd emerged from a civil war in a period of absolutely convulsive trauma. And people embraced it and welcomed it.
That you see, do you know, I'm so glad you mentioned that. And it is funny how we, because the parallel that's sometimes been in my mind with Putin is, you know, I obviously think Putin is a terrible person and wish him, I mean, I hope listeners won't be offended when I say I really do wish him all the worst. But how is, he's on a spectrum. And somewhere on that spectrum is Octavian, you know, who becomes Augustus, who obscure, people don't rate him, you know, does deals with the right people, can be utterly ruthless and cold.
Well, I think the difference is that, obviously, Octavian, the murderous terrorist who utilizes war to attain supreme power and then promote himself as a prince of peace, the arc of Putin is the other way, that he's gone from presiding over, bit taking in the West, appearing to be a man with Bush looks into his soul and it's good, who is now, you know, the new Hitler.
Yeah, I suppose so. But but surely, you know, you think about Octavian and his war, for example, against Antony and Cleopatra, the way that Russian Augustan propaganda.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I mean, the version they, no Roman would have got a sense of that war as we have of it. Would they? I mean, even our sense of the war is completely colored by their propaganda.
Yeah,
so Putin's
completely.
Propaganda is not unprecedented in history.
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. No. I mean, he truly is the third Rome.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, that's a depressing thought. I told you when we started, you know, I said I've got the flipping piles of notes. And I know they've got the names of people running, you know, the under minister of tractors.
Yes, in Minsk.
That I haven't been able to use. But there are some brilliant books on this. There's a book by Sergei Plokhy, a Ukrainian historian, called The Last Empire, I think it is, about Ukraine and the collapse of the Soviet Union. There's the book I mentioned last time, Vladislav Zubok's book. And there are two other books, Tom, that I'd like to mention, because I think they're absolutely brilliant. They're by the New Yorker editor, David Remnick, and he's talking about Russia in the late 80s and then in the early 90s. Now, I can remember that the second one is called Resurrection. And I can't actually remember the name of the first one, having said how brilliant they are, but I like to leave the listener something to do. No, it's not Crucifixion. I like to leave the listener something to do so they
Lenin's
can look it
tomb.
Up for them. It is Lenin's Tomb. Yeah. Our producers just, that is an absolutely unbelievably good book. So I really recommend that.
Would you say it's a riddle wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in a mystery?
Well, I think that's going back to that kind of thing that we talked about in the last podcast, yes. Which is about the Russian soul, isn't it? I think there were, I'll tell you the great what if, Tom. I mean, this is the great what if of our time. What if the Soviet Union hadn't broken up? Would a lot of people, a lot of people who are anti-communists would say, God, what a terrible, you know, speculation. But there is surely an argument that a lot of people who are now dead would still be alive, actually, if the Soviet Union had kept going. If, let's say, Andropov had lived for another 10 years and then handed over to somebody more hard-nosed than Gorbachev, that it would still have been a bit repressive and autocratic, but it would have moved towards a market economy. Maybe still bad things would have happened, but perhaps not on the scale of the Chechen wars and the...
But, well, except what I'd say to that is that ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, the one thing that people across the world have been able to draw solace from is the fact that nuclear war between two rival superpowers is unlikely. And perhaps I think the most unsettling aspect of the current crisis is that Putin is now starting to talk about using nuclear weapons. And one of the reason that's disturbing is that people say, oh, it's just gamemanship. But every threat he's delivered, every threat that he's said, he has actually acted on.
Yes, there was a brilliant article by a woman called Fiona Hill, who's a
the British soft Russian expert in Washington, right?
Exactly, the British expert who's recently been involved in all kinds of shenanigans in Washington, and she said, you know, every time people say he won't do this,
He does.
He does. Yeah. And in a way, that's the surprise about Putin, that he's turned out not to be this sort of coldly ruthless chess player, but he looks now more like a gambler whose gambles have succeeded and succeeded and succeeded, and now he's taken the biggest gamble of all. And it'll, as people often say, it'll either end with the destruction of Ukraine or the destruction of himself and his regime.
Well, do you think the paradox is that he has been such a genius at creating confusion, master of illusion?
Master of illusion? You make it sound like David Blaine.
Well, but, you know, the hybrid warfare,
yeah,
getting people to believe things that aren't true, all that kind of thing, that he has now come to believe something that's not true, and he's kind of fallen into his own trap. Would that be?
I think there is an element. I think he's done that classic thing that dictators do. He listens to his own ideology too much, and people, you know, he lives in his echo chamber with his massive table, and he never hears competing opinions, and he obviously completely underestimated the Ukrainians, you know, their belief that they are actually a nation. And frankly, I hope he pays a very heavy price for it. Sorry, this is a very morbid end to the podcast, Tom.
Well, it's a morbid subject, isn't it?
It is a morbid subject.
It's hard not to feel
depressed. So we shall be back. We shall be back, hopefully, with more jolly material. Maybe Tom will do some impersonations next time to cheer us up. and on that note, we'll say thank you for listening. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.